Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're in Esther chapter 3 and 4 today. Last time we left it with the plot developing as Mordecai has been introduced and found out a plot and brought his niece to the palace for the beauty contest. And Esther has become queen after outshining many, many other young women. And now the third major character in this plot, the guy with the black hat, is about to appear. Notice in chapter 3. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Now Ahasuerus, of course, is Xerxes I, we believe, though the Septuagint and Josephus have Artaxerxes II, which has caused some disruption as far as the theories of the date. The son of Hammedatha, the Agite. And there's been a lot of discussion about that. The real hassle is going to be, is this man a foreigner? Now, the Agite seems to mean that he is a relative or apostle relative of Agag, the king of the Amalekites, the traditional enemy of the people of God. Now, the Amalekites are mentioned in Exodus 17, 8 through 16, Numbers 24, 7, 1 Samuel 15:8, and 1 Chronicles 4:42 and 43. They were ancient enemies during the conquest period and the wilderness wandering period. And God had said, they're going to always be a problem to you. So is this man related to Agag the king? It seems highly unusual, though there is some archaeological evidence of the multiracial makeup of the Persian leadership in this period. It still really seems funny that someone from that far away in the province would be the second man, or the man right under the king. So we must remember that the etymology of these names and geographical sites many times is just absolutely unknown. I really think this is probably a place name and not Agag's relative. Although, it does seem to fit as one of the possible reasons why Mordecai would not bow down to him. That's been one of the theories. And we'll get into that in just a minute. Notice where it says, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. So he became the chief administrative officer, much like Daniel or Joseph had become. Haman became that. Now, notice it says in verse 2, and all the king's servants who at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman. And so the king had commanded concerning him. Now, we're not real sure about this homage to the king. As you know, they're Zoroastrians, and they weren't considered to be gods as they were in the, Egypt or Tyre. But exactly what kind of cultural protocol was at court, we're not sure. Some have said the reason the king commanded his servants to bow down to Haman is he was a foreigner, and the servants didn't want to do it, so the king commanded him. Now, the whole plot's going to thicken with the fact that Mordecai is not going to bow down. And here's why. Notice it says, so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Now, there's been a lot of theories about that. Some say it's much like Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or the other names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego of Daniel chapter 3. If they said he would not bow down because it involves some kind of worship. Now, that may be true. I'm just not sure. The second theory has been, and this again is those older Jewish commentators, Targum 1, Targum 2, those kind of older Jewish comments on the text, that Haman had around his neck an idol, a ward on a necklace. And Mordecai would not bow down to that idol. Well, that's possible, though. I don't know where they get that from. But if you don't get it from the text, they get it from oral tradition. Now, the third one is that Mordecai would not bow down to a descendant of Agag, who was a historical and traditional enemy of the people of Israel. Now, do you see how sometimes this interpretation starts really whirling around itself? The text does not say that. And it doesn't say why. But all these theories begin to be interwoven. And you know what? If you take these theories as dogmatic, suddenly you're three steps away from the text and you're getting dogmatic about a theory and you're building all this evidence to back up your theory when there's nothing in the text to support it. We've really got to be careful of that because I think we're so guilty of that. And we make an assumption. We base everything on that assumption. We force all the Bible to fit that assumption. then we claim biblical authority for our assumption. Be careful. We don't know why he wouldn't bow down. Maybe he had bad knees. I just don't know. Then the king's servant, who at the king's gate, again, Mordecai is related to the gate, said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command?" There's been a lot of question here. It's obvious that Mordecai would have had to bow down to the king himself. So bowing down can't be the problem. Why not to Haman? That's been the real question. And the people are saying, this was a specific command of the king, and you're breaking the king's command. And so we don't know, but it was a serious problem. Verse 4. That was when they had spoken daily to him. They kept on over and over for a series of days, and he would not listen to them if they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Now, some reason that Mordecai wouldn't bow down was connected with Mordecai being a Jew. Now, how it's connected, we're just not certain. But now, whether the friends at court were just exasperated because of his unwillingness or because they were out to get him, we don't know from the text. And when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. Now, here's pride and arrogance, and he was threatened and paranoid and all the rest. Exactly what, we don't know, but he really got mad. He got so mad, he's not only going to take out his vengeance on Mordecai, but on all of Mordecai's people. The plot thickens. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews throughout the Persian Empire. Wow, what vengeance. Man, this guy really had a root of bitterness, didn't he? In verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. Now, Esther would have been queen for about 5 years now. Okay, she'd been in court a long time. Pur, look in your translation, P-U-R, that is, the lot was cast before Haman. Now, this seems to be the etymological relationship to the Feast of Purim. Purim, which is, this book seems to be the background of how they got that feast. Now, Pur, we've learned from archaeological evidence, meant lots or dice or the casting of lots or dice. It's interesting that one of the archaeologists in the city of Susa has found a triangular-shaped cube that has certain numbers on it that was probably much like this dice. This was done in Israel, too. The Urim and the Thummim, kept in the breastplate of the high priest, was also a way of casting these lots to know the will of God. They divided the promised land by casting lots. Even in the New Testament time, to pick the successor for Judas Iscariot was done by lots. It was a way to know the will of God's. Now, Haman seems to be superstitious. This seems to be more Babylonian than Persian. So apparently he got some soothsayers or diviners or magi or sorcerers or somebody, because it says the lots were cast before Haman. Now apparently he's looking for a certain day. So they cast it day by day and month by month. He's looking for the day to approach the king and set the execution for all the Jews. And so apparently he cast the dice on day one. No, it came out. No, he cast the dice on day two. It came on day 13. Then he cast the dice for the month it should be. What month should we do this? Now, apparently, his idea that a certain day was finally picked and a certain month was finally picked was divine sanction for his plan seems to be obvious from the text. Okay? And it was the 12th month, the month of Adar. So it's about 11 months ahead of time. That gave the Jews plenty of time to plan their strategy. All right? Haman's superstition finally got himself hung. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispensed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom," which shows the Jews were still very spread out. Only a small number returned to Jerusalem. There was a large Jewish community in these large capitals. Then it says, "Their laws are different from those of other people." This is the only mention in all the book of the word laws. And it's just a bleak reference. Here, different is a crime. Do you catch that? It's the basis of racial bigotry, isn't it? Different means bad, okay? And they do not observe the king's laws. Now, what an exaggeration. That's not true. He's taken Mordecai's one example of not bowing down and extrapolating that to all the people not obeying all the laws. Now, it's funny that he doesn't really mention Mordecai's name or mention the name of the people, the Jews. He just says a people. And notice what happens. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put the king's treasuries. This is an unbelievable amount of money. Now, I don't know how to put it in monetary equivalent, but let's do it this way. We learned from archaeological evidence this was two-thirds of the annual budget of the kingdom of Persia. Two-thirds the annual budget. Well, take the annual budget of the United States, take two-thirds of it, and you see the astonishing amount. Now, there's either a scribal error here. It's either a way of talking about the wealth of Haman, which may be the reason why he was appointed. But it also shows the degree of hatred that this man developed that he was willing to give this much money. And apparently it did tempt the king. For at this period, he lost a lot of money in his expense in this Greek war and never really recouped it. Now, the king gave him the signet ring, a sign of his authority, from his hand, and gave it to Haman, the enemy of the Jew. And the king said to Haman, "The silver is yours." Now, some say, well, he didn't want the money. Well, this may be, I know it sounds funny, but just listen to me, the beginning of a bargaining procedure. If you've ever been to the Oriental Bazaar in Jerusalem on a trip, you know how you got to kind of haggle with them for the price. Maybe the king is haggling here. I just don't know. But anyway, isn't it unbelievable that the king would give over a whole destruction of a people without even knowing the cause and the name of the people? Wow. Okay, then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. It was written just as Haman commanded the king's satraps, governors, and princes. Now, here are three levels of administration. The satraps were over the large areas. It seems the most satraps there ever were was about 30. Now, the governors, like Ezra and Nehemiah, were smaller administrators in these larger satrapies. And then the princes were kind of the local officials or the local leaders. And this seems to be three levels. The Persians had many levels of administration, we know from their own writings and from history. It be written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. The letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews. Isn't that unbelievable? Both young and old, women and children, one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, to seize their possessions as plunder. Now, some of them said the seizing their possessions is where Haman's going to get the 10,000 talents of silver. And that would be true. Maybe Haman is going to pay men to kill the Jews, and he's going to pay them by the plunder and property they get from the Jews. Either that, or he had a whole lot of money, and we're just not sure. Notice the cruelty of this. Men and women, children. Boy, it's going to be a total annihilation. Now, the copy of the edict was issued as a law, and every province was published to all the people. It was written in all the different languages, so that they should be ready for this day. And the couriers went out and impelled to the king's command, while the decree was issued at Susa, the capital, and while the king and Haman sat down to drink. And here's literary ploy. The king and Haman are drinking over here, getting crocked about this. The city of Susa was in confusion. Now, one or two things have been discussed by commentators. The people had a higher sense of morality and justice than the king. That's a possibility. It's a positive thing. Or they were saying, oh, who's a Jew so we can kill them and get their property? They're already planning what they were going to do. Now, which it is, we're just not certain. The Hebrew here can't be defined. Chapter 4. Now, Mordecai learned all that had been done. He tore his clothes, put sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the street and wailed loudly and bitterly. Now, Oriental mourning is really a loud ritual kind of thing. Now, some have said he is mourning because he didn't bow down to Haman, and his reluctance caused this problem to his whole people. But that doesn't seem quite right. He's just grieved over what's happened, and he's outwardly showing his mourning. And he's going to walk around, and he can't even notice he comes to the king's gate again. Again, he's connected to this gate, but he couldn't get in because you can't wear sackcloth and get in the palace. And then the couriers, look at verse 4, they told Esther what was happening. Her maidens and the eunuchs that served her said, well, this guy you know. The reason they knew that is Mordecai had asked about Esther several times, and they knew they were friends. They weren't sure of the connection. They were both Jewish, but they knew they were friends. And so they tell Esther, boy, this friend of yours is acting really strange. And Esther sends some clothes out there. And Mordecai won't put them on. There's been a lot of theories about why. Some have said, well, the reason for his mourning had not stopped. That's Josephus. Others have said it was against the law to mourn publicly for private sense, something private. But Mordecai is not mourning for private things, but for the national disaster about to come on his people. And some say that's why he wouldn't quit mourning. We just don't know. Notice in verse 4, the queen writhed in great anger. Well, she was concerned and hurt because her the one who brought her up and loved her and she loved him was in such trouble. So she had this eunuch named Hatcheth, and he was trusted, and he went and is going to be an intermediator between Esther and Mordecai. And Mordecai, look at verse 7, told him all that had happened to him, the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasury for the destruction of the Jews, and also gave him a copy of the text which had been issued at Susa for the destruction that might show Esther and inform her in order for her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. Now, Mordecai is saying, Esther, you've got to do something. You're in a place of responsibility. You're in a place of power. You need to do something. Now, look at what happens. Verse 9 through 11. 9 through 12, Esther answers Mordecai. And apparently, it's an answer that it seems a bit official. And it seems a little funny she would say this. She's going to say, I can't do it. And no one can go into the king unless the king calls for him. If they do, they'll be killed. And we know from history that was true. Herodotus tells there was these seven families that could approach the king any time. But others could not on fear of death unless the king accepted their presence. So Esther says, I can't go in there. He hasn't called me for a month. Apparently, she had kind of fallen out somewhat of favor after all these years. He wasn't as passionate as he had been earlier. It had been a month since he had called for. And she's saying, I can't go. And Mordecai gets a little upset about what she says. And then in verses 12 through 17 is a crux in the interpretation of this book. He's going to say, Esther, do you think you're going to be spared because you're in the palace? You're Jewish. When it's found out, and they know they can get your property and your resources because of this king's edict, and the edict can't be changed, Esther, you're next on the line too. Now, the answer seems to be that Mordecai thought Esther was saying, well, I'm out of it. It didn't involve me. What's it going to get for me? But, you know, the whole picture of Esther in this book is not a person like that. Maybe she, as a young woman, was genuinely concerned with the appropriateness of her acts, and she wanted to do the right thing. And Mordecai's just saying to her, now, hun, I want you to think through this. You're next on the line, too. Look what else he says. For if you remain silent at this time, it's going to be a strong warning and threat, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. Apparently, she had other brothers and sisters or relatives anyway. Now, this is one of the places that seems to imply God. God's name is not used. Matter of fact, Yahweh, the covenant name for God, Adonai, the word for Lord or Master, El Shaddai, God Almighty, none of the names, not any derivatives, not even any paraphrastic uses is like God's throne or heaven. None of that's used in this, but this is the closest we get right here, that deliverance will come from another source. And the implication is not political, but divine. And so here is a reference. And though the name of God's not mentioned, you see the great faith of Mordecai here. He's saying, Esther, God brought you to a time like this. But if you're unfaithful, God will deliver us some way else, though you'll suffer personal loss in your family. It's kind of a threat, but it's also a great faith. Look what he says. And who knows whether you have attained royalty for such a time as this? This is a very famous quote. Most folks know this, only this quote from Esther. And this is the idea of divine providence. It's the idea that God is really in control of our lives. Now, I must admit to you, I do not understand all about God's will and God's providence in the lives of believers. I've always thought that God's will is kind of like a tree. Many branches, some big trunks and some lesser branches. We have an option in the will of God to be free moral agents. And sometimes when we say no, it's not that our lives are totally cut off from God, but that it may be some opportunities and some choices are cut off. But God always has a will and a plan for anybody who'll turn to Him. And so Mordecai brings this great faith in this providence of God to Esther when he says, maybe everything that's happened to you, all the good things that happened to you, that you're a beautiful woman, that you were pleasing to the king, the king's heart was turned toward you, that the king's chief eunuch helped you out, that you're in a place of responsibility. Maybe all of this, Esther, happened through God's will for exactly this moment. Now, that's a sobering thought. Have you ever thought that who you are, your training, your desires, your particular gifts and responsibilities and popularity or intellect or possessions, that God has provided that for His use? You know, I really believe that's true. I think we forget that when life becomes so self-centered. And Esther is either bartering on this self-centeredness or she's just being very honest with a young girl saying, well, I'm a little scared. Which it is, I don't know. I wonder about your life. Do you see your life in the plan of God? Do you see everything you have as resources that come from God? Do you believe that your life is not chance or fate or circumstance or horoscope or could be or maybe or possibly, but that your life, with some personal choices involved, is in an overarching divine plan? That is a real good point for us to stop and think in our day. Now, in verse 15, then Esther told them to reply to Malachi, wants to send back to Mordecai her response. Go assemble all the Jews. The word assemble here is the idea to get the Jews together in Susa and fast for me. Now, notice prayer is not mentioned. Now, why prayer is not mentioned, I don't know. But it's obvious to me that in this context, it's obvious they're talking about fasting and praying. And this is going to be a total fast. No food, no drink, night and day, staying awake. Now, if it was just a fast, you'd go to sleep at night. But they're to stay awake night and day. The implication is to pray and seek God's will, ask God's favor on this enterprise the queen's about to attempt. Okay? Night and day, for 3 days. And I and my maidens will also fast the same way. Now, these were Persian maidens. How much exactly they understood about God and His will, I don't know. But I've always been amazed that Zoroastrians, they are the wise men that came to Jesus' birth from the east, the Magi. They were Zoroastrians. There is a lot of affinity between the worship of Yahweh, monotheism, and Zoroastrianism, which is also a monotheistic faith in Ahura Mazda. The basic difference between the two is that Zoroastrianism is more of a dualism. It's not a complete dualism, but it is a limited dualism between good and evil, or Ahura Mazda, the good god, and Angra Mayenta, the evil god. But there is a great closeness. Many very liberal scholars believe that the Jews were influenced in the interbiblical period in their understanding of heaven and hell and angels and demons and the place of Satan from this Zoroastrian dualism. Now, I'm not sure about that. But these maidens, Esther felt confident enough that they could fast with her and pray for religious purposes these 3 days. So we got the Jewish community with Mordecai praying. We got Esther and her servants praying in the palace for God's will and favor, apparently, for her to approach the king. And thus I will go to the king, which is not according to the law. No one could come into his private audience unless they were summoned, okay? And if I perish, I perish. Now somebody said, well, this is fatalism. I don't think it's fatalism. I think it's a young Jewish girl saying, you know, I do believe God's in control of my life. And if this is what God wants for me, even if I die, it's okay. This is very similar to me to the Daniel chapter 3 we made allusion to earlier. The three young Hebrew boys saying to Nebuchadnezzar, our God is able to deliver us out of your hand. Whether He will or not, we do not know. We may die, they're saying, but we're not going to bow down to your idol. Well, Esther's saying the same thing. I'm going in there in faith in God and His purpose for my life. I don't know if I'm going to live or die, but I'm going. Now, notice the practicality in faith. On one hand, she says, I'm going to pray. I'm going to seek God's face. But whether God answers the way I want to or not, I'm going to do it. Hey, that's a pretty good combination of practicality and piety. And I think we need both. I think God honors both. I really do. Okay, so Mordecai went away and did as Esther had commanded him. Now, next we're going to do chapters 5 through 7, and we'll get into the specifics of this. Now, I want to mention this book to you again, Introduction to the Old Testament by R.K. Harrison. It has a detailed discussion. Some of the intricacies of the book of Esther are just not available to English readers. The commentaries are scarce. Even the historical books, like A History of Israel by bright. Don't cover Esther real well. This would be helpful. It'll show you some of the palace intrigue and all the things that are happening. And boy, the plot's really thickening now. We're coming to the crux of the matter. And it's a crux of faith. Now, I know the name's not mentioned. The name of God's not mentioned. I know prayer's not mentioned. I know Jerusalem and the temple aren't mentioned. But don't you catch the faith of these people? The faith of Mordecai, the faith of Esther, the evil and the hatred of Haman, the fickleness of the king being manipulated, all of it's coming together now. And I think it really has some application to our day. Now, I know it's not the specific application of the book of Romans, and I know it's not the great truth of the Gospels, but it is a very practical truth of how men and women of faith live in the crisis of histories with faith in God. And not only that, but how God is really involved in the working out even of the smallest parts of our lives. My brothers and sisters, I want to assure you, God's in control of your life. Things just don't happen to you. I hope you can face the crisis of your life knowing that God is able and ready to do that which is appropriate. And sometimes the settings of crisis show our faith in God more than good times and success ever could. Hang in there. God's in control. God loves you. Things just don't happen. It's a good word. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again next week. We'll do chapters 5 through 7. God bless you. Have a good day.